This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. One love, one heart, let's join together and I'll feel all right. Almost 25 years after his death, Bob Marley's face adorns T-shirts across the globe. Time magazine chose his record Exodus as the best album of the 20th century. The New York Times, in search of just one video for its millennial time capsule, chose Bob Marley, live at the Rainbow, London, 1977. In Ethiopia today, a month-long celebration begins to mark what would have been Bob Marley's 60th birthday. We thought it time to consider the contributions of a man who came to define a musical style but was much more than a musician, the music, religion, politics, and the legacy of Bob Marley. Later in the program, tsunami-hit countries appeal for tourists to return and Colombia's battle against rebels inside and outside the country. But first, Bob Marley and reggae music. If you have questions about who he was, what he believed, and what he accomplished, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now is Roger Steffens, a reggae and Bob Marley historian. He's with us by phone from his travels now in San Juan, Puerto Rico. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you so much, Neil. It's a delight to be with you.
You've argued that Bob Marley is the most important musical figure of the 20th century. How come?
Well, for a variety of reasons, and I don't think it's just me. I remember at the Millennium, the New York Times said he was the most influential musician of the second half of the 20th century. The first half, by the way, they chose Louis Armstrong, and both those men were lifelong herb smokers, so go figure.
Yeah.
And his influence just continues to grow more and more in the 24 years since his passing. I just did a 12-day tour of seven cities in Australia, and you would think he was a national hero in that country, particularly among the Aboriginal people. Native peoples around the world regard him almost as a deity. The Hopi Indians, the Havasupai, who live in the bottom of the Grand Canyon, feel that Bob Marley is the fulfillment of some of their ancient prophecies. So, as you said in the beginning, he's a figure who transcends music to become a spiritual and a moral figure. Jack Healey, the head of Amnesty International, says everywhere he goes in the world today, Bob Marley is the symbol of freedom. So it's a remarkable accomplishment for someone who's been gone all this time to just get more and more important.
There, as we mentioned, there's a celebration beginning in Ethiopia this month to celebrate Marley's 60th birthday, and this has accompanied some controversy over where Bob Marley's body should be buried. It is now in Jamaica. His wife has said she wants to move it to Ethiopia.
Yeah, and she just reiterated that yesterday. I saw an AP report on that. She's a brave woman. She's incurring the enmity of the entire nation of Jamaica. There was a firestorm of controversy in Jamaica a couple of weeks ago when she first made the announcement that she planned to exhume Bob's body and put it into a grave in Shashamani, Ethiopia, which is an odd move, I think. When Bob was dying, he had the choice of going anywhere in the world, and he was flying back to his real home in Jamaica to do that. He got as far as Miami and died in a hospital there on May 11th, 1981, from melanoma at 36. So Rita keeps talking about Bob's wishes to bring Bob, his body, to Ethiopia, and I don't remember ever hearing or reading of any such wish, so it's interesting to see where that's coming from. Nobody can quite understand the motivation for her desire to do this. He's so associated with Jamaica. His mother built a 25-room motel in the little village of Nine Mile where his body now rests. She'd probably go bankrupt if the body were moved. Who wants to come and see an empty tomb? Mm. So it's a strange situation.
You mentioned some peoples around the world regard Bob Marley as the embodiment of some of their spiritual aspirations. We can't mention him. The reason, of course, that he might want to go to Ethiopia or might be thought to want to go to Ethiopia is his connection to his religion, Rastafarian, Emperor Haile Selassie, and Ethiopia.
Precisely. But in Ethiopia, you'd be hard-pressed to find too many people who believe that Haile Selassie is God Almighty incarnate in these times, which is a central belief of the Rastafari faith. The small community of expatriate Rasta who live in Shashamani on land that Selassie gave them are riven with divisions and controversy between various factions of Rasta. Some of them believe Selassie is God, others believe he is the reincarnation of Jesus in these times, and some of them see him merely as a wonderful man, but no more than that, and they all call themselves Rasta. So who would have control over Bob's body in Shashamani and therefore reap the benefits of it financially? I mean, there's just a ton of problems in the offing if they move the body.
We're talking today about the music and the legacy of Bob Marley. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. 800-989-TALK. Email is TOTN at NPR.org. And let's begin with Elizabeth, who's calling from Jacksonville, Florida.
Yes, hi. I met Bob Marley once. I'm from Trinidad, and my ex-husband was working on the island of Tortola. And Tortola was a British colony, is a British colony, but they have U.S. currency. So you used to have all these film stars and artists come and with suitcases of money to bank. and Bob Marley was one of those who flew in one weekend, and my husband had to meet him specially to deposit the money in Barclays Bank at the time, and you know, he was a very mild-mannered, very deeply spiritual. The brief time we spent with him really had a depth of spirituality that I'm not sure people really understood, but it certainly came out in his songs. And the other thing I wanted to say is, coming from the Caribbean, the reggae, the whole reggae music has permeated throughout, for instance, the Calypso, where I come from, it's permeated so much to the point where sometimes I'm a little bit upset that it has convoluted the pure form of Calypso. And you get this type of reggae now that is sort of, I think it's almost negative, quite frankly. So it's to hear you talk about Bob Marley just brings back a lot of memories, both because I met him and, of course, because I'm from the Caribbean. So I just wanted to say that.
Well, thank you very much for the call, Elizabeth. We appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
Let's talk a little bit, Roger Steffens, about Bob Marley's early days. Now, he did not invent reggae music, but he certainly popularized it.
Well, he certainly helped invent it because he started in the very earliest days of Jamaica's own music, which would be the ska era.
Mm-hmm.
He made his first recordings at the beginning of 1973 for a man named Leslie Kong, who went on to do My Boy Lollipop and the Israelites. Then he formed the Wailers, and that group began recording in 1964 for Cox and Dodd, the great Jamaican producer many people have compared to Berry Gordy and the Motown label, because most of the major stars started out with Coxon in the ska era. And then there was a little period from 66 to 68 when they changed the beat of the music, slowed it down, and removed the horns and called it rock steady. And the Wailers made some of the best rock steady music, and some of it really bordered on what we now know as reggae. But reggae was pretty much invented in the studios in Kingston in 1968. So Bob was active from 1964 right to the end of his life in 1980, keeping up with the trends and making the trends happen himself, especially when he recorded with Lee Scratch Perry, the mad Jamaican producer whose goal it is to hijack the earth. And a lot of people consider the trio work of Bunny Wailer and Peter Tosh and Bob Marley, the original Wailers, the work they did with Lee Perry as the best work of their career.
Well, let's listen to an early Bob Marley. In fact, this is the first song ever released, Judge Not, issued in 1962. Well, you can certainly hear both a voice and a rhythm that had yet to mature, but not bad for 17.
Now, that's a perfect track, Neil, to play because it illustrates another important facet of Bob Marley's career. He was constantly reinventing his music. That's the first song he wrote when he was about 16, and it's a very mature lyric. And the road of life is rocky, and you may stumble too, but while you point the finger, somebody else is judging you, so judge not before you judge yourself. And he recycled it 17 years later, in 1979, as the chorus to his disco hit, Could You Be Loved? Only now it was the I-3 singing, The road of life is rocky, you may stumble too, and while you point the finger, someone else is judging you. Could you be loved?
Let's get another caller on the conversation. John is with us from Loomis, California.
Hi, how's it going, Neil?
All right.
I just wanted to say, you know, to a lot of the people who really don't even understand why people listen to Bob Marley's music, it's more than just the music and the atmosphere and what a lot of people think people are doing while they're listening to Bob's music. But he actually, where I grew up in a very white suburbia area on a golf course and whatnot, it actually can teach you, when you go and listen to his music, not to judge people, and especially his first song there, Judgment, the ska era, he was trying to explain to people that there's no need to see other people other than the color of their eyes, you know, and the color of their skin didn't mean nothing. And so many people out there, why do you listen to Bob's music? They don't even understand, and I'm sure there's so many people listening right now that still don't understand. Most of the people that get into Bob's music and stay with it for years, like I have, it's more than the music. It's what it's teaching you about reality and how to treat other people. And you go to places that have, now especially Florida and California, they have Bob Marley shows, not necessarily of him, but his family even has the Marley Tour, that they have shows going all year long. And it's amazing when you go to one of those things, the community and the friendship that's going on, where the second you walk out of that building, it's gone, especially in places like San Francisco, where, you know, there's a huge, huge group of people. When you're in that environment, everyone's a good friend.
John, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it. We'll take more of your calls and emails when we return from a break. More on reggae, also from an expert who grew up in Jamaica as the music gained popularity. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan. This is NPR News.
People we need, yeah. Good friends we have, oh, good friends we have lost along the way.
This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking today about how Bob Marley would have turned 60 this weekend. What do you know or would like to know about the man and his music? Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Our guest is Roger Steffens, a reggae historian, and wanted to read an email we got from Natalie Knazik. There we go. I studied abroad in Tibet 2 years ago, and I'd never been a Marley fan. Our Tibetan guides had a tape that a tourist had left them at one point, and they loved singing along to it. Once we got to know each other better, they would ask us what the lyrics meant. It was incredibly moving to talk to people living in a situation as politically controlling as China and see the effect on them of listening to music about a situation so different, but in many ways analogous to theirs. Since then, I enjoy listening to Bob Marley. It reminds me of one of the most incredible times of my life and of amazing people and their profound courage and strength. Bob Marley's influence almost everywhere, Roger Steffens.
Yeah, that's a very eloquent testimony to that. And, you know, from the bottom of the Grand Canyon to the top of the Himalayas, everyone seems to know the music of Bob Marley. He eschewed politics. He called them crime ministers who sit in the House of Represent the Thief. And his music was profoundly political. He had scorching political acumen. And he spoke of the plight of the sufferers, and as long as that condition exists on the planet, they're going to be singing Bob's songs of freedom. His art director, Neville Garrick, described it best, Neil. He called Bob's music the new Psalms.
Let me ask you something. You've made reference to it, so did one of our callers. Bob Marley used marijuana. It was part of the Rastafari religion. There were a lot of people who, the first time they heard about this religion, said, this is crazy, it's just got to be a justification for smoking a lot of dope. Obviously, that was not the situation with Bob Marley, but what part did it play in his life?
A major part, and he would never call it dope, he would call it herb, because herb was ordained by the Bible to be the healing of the nation. And as he said, rather humorously, to a reporter in New Zealand back in 79, alcohol make you drunk, herb make you think. it made you more sensitive. And anytime people ask me that kind of question, I always point to the fact that Bob wrote immortal anthems like Get Up, Stand Up and Redemption Song and No Woman, No Cry under the influence of herb, which he smoked from the time he got up. He waked and baked and smoked it all during the day. But it was not done for jollification, as he would say. It was done for education. It was done to increase the proximity to the Creator. And that's why he spoke of I and I, because God is in us. God is us. We are all together. It is I and I, not you and I, because you means the illusion of difference, and that is devilism. So we are all one and the same manifestation of the Almighty.
For Jamaicans, reggae is more than a musical genre. It's a way of life. Joining us now to talk about this is Chris Wilson, Vice President of Artists and Repertoire at Heartbeat Records. He's with us from the studios at member station WBUR in Boston. Welcome.
Great. It's good to be here.
Now, you grew up in Jamaica. Tell us how reggae is a way of life there.
Well, when I was a kid in the late 50s, we listened to music like how much is that doggy in the window and stuff like that. And then all of a sudden, when independence happened in 1961, there was this explosion of a Jamaican identity, and ska, which you heard earlier, became kind of the soundtrack of that change from British colonialism to Jamaican independence.
So an anthem, even in just the way it spoke to the people.
Right, and you would have Jamaican songs becoming topical because there were songs about independence. Almost anything that had happened in Jamaica, a song would be there. It was kind of like the poor people's newspapers.
What was the beginning of your bond with reggae?
The early 60s, there was someone who worked for my family who worked in the yard. He was a yard boy. And he was always dressing up on weekends. And, you know, I was young and was always kind of thinking how silly he looked. He looked like a waiter. But actually, he was going out and dancing at these very famous Jamaican dance halls. So I was like saying, what are you doing? And one day he brought me back a few records. And I heard them, and it was just, it opened my eyes to another world that I hadn't even known existed. And it was, you know, an epiphany for me. And I always, from then on, got involved and followed different labels, different producers like Mr. Dodd that you heard about earlier.
Well, Bob Marley, it took a while for Jamaicans to come to appreciate him, but here is one of his first songs that he had some success with. It's a song that was particularly topical to the period. This is Simmer Down, recorded in 1963 at Studio One. Chris Wilson, why was this song important?
Well, actually, this song, even though it has a very topical, makes topical reference to violence, it really was a diatribe against a competing producer who also ran shows, dances. And basically, there was, you know, violence as one sound system, as they were called, would try to take control and be the ruling, you know, the king of the dance hall. And Coxon was, you know, one of the biggest, and Duke Reed was another big one. And they would have gangs that would kind of disrupt the dances. So Simmer Down is like, it's kind of a, you know, a veiled threat to him, you know, to simmer down.
So you have to know how to read the music between the lines.
But, well, Reggae, but also, you know, if I may interrupt here for a second.
Hi, Roger.
Really, a music you have to meet halfway, because a lot of it is in patois. You have to learn about Jamaican politics and current affairs, and it leads to Ethiopia and the Bible. And one of the things that you have to try to figure out, and Chris has been a huge help to us over the years, is when exactly this music was made. Even though it's modern music, there were virtually no records kept. And Leroy Jody Pearson and I have just finished a 14-year project. It's a definitive discography of the Wailers' recording career, and Chris found a tape that was dated in July of 64 for Simmer Down, even though all the books say it's 63. So there are still major mysteries in Bob's life, even though it was a modern career.
Let's get another caller in on the conversation, and this is Sam, who joins us from Punta Gorda in Florida.
Neil, thank you very much for putting me on the show. I couldn't think of a better one to be on.
Oh, thanks.
I've loved reggae for a very long time. I credit my good friend Amanda for turning me on to the music, and I'll forever be grateful to her for that. If I may relate a quick story, I went once when I was in school in Portland, Oregon, to see a show by the Congos, who are a wonderful harmony group, very classic. They go back a long way, and they're very well respected in the business. And I was very disappointed when I got there to find that I and my two friends were the only people in the audience. And it occurred to me at that point that as great as Bob was, and don't get me wrong, he's a wonderful man, he's a spiritual man, but perhaps his greatness could have done something to overshadow the greatness of reggae around him. There were so many wonderful musicians that, honestly, nobody's ever heard of and may never hear of again.
Interesting, Sam. Here's an email I just wanted to read we got from Amir in St. Louis. Sitting in my cubicle in St. Louis, Missouri, listening to your show, I clearly picture me and my friends being desperate teenagers living under the dictatorship of the Islamic Republic of Iran and selling our hearts and souls to Bob's redemption song and dancing to his beat. He is a permanent part of my life and, like me's, filled with lots and lots of nostalgic memories.
You'd be amazed, Neil, how many people around the world have learned English just so they could penetrate the lyrics of Bob Marley. But he did set the bar very high, as the caller from Florida said. He was so far and away above the rest of the field that he did make it a little difficult for anyone to follow him. And the Congos were Lee Perry's studio band at the Upsetters studio in Kingston, and a major group in the eyes of collectors.
Well, Chris.
Nobody went to their show. I mean,
and nobody went to their show. How sad.
Yes, it was. It depressed me very much. Can I ask a quick question?
Sure.
Is there truth to Lee Perry's? Did he thieve Kaya? Did he take the rights from that from Bob Marley somehow?
He claims that he co-wrote most of the sessions. Family Man said that there were often Family Man being the leader of the Upsetters band, who became the leader of Bob's Wailers band. He said they would often go off Bob and Lee Perry and work on songs together. But I don't think we'll ever know precisely who contributed what. I've been studying it for 32 years, and I still can't come up with a definitive answer.
Well, no doubt, Lee Perry is a great man too. I've got respect for them all.
Yeah.
Sam, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Chris Wilson, before we let you go, where do you think reggae and the legacy of Bob Marley is headed today?
Well, I mean, as you know, and probably Roger has told you, that one of the largest selling records in the business is Bob Marley's Legend.
Mm-hmm.
Reggae has really split into two opposing camps in some respects. One, which are the guys who like, you know, the Bob Marley roots type of artists, and those who like dancehall. And dancehall, which is more like Sean Paul, and it's more allied to American rap music, is really what is selling today in terms of the reggae field. The more cultural artists that come from the past, so to speak, are really kind of stuck in there. And as you know, Roger was saying, is that Bob did really overshadow quite a lot of these groups, and they have never been able to achieve the same kind of popularity that he had, and the marketplace isn't really conducive to helping them anymore the way it was in the late 70s and early 80s.
In a way, reggae predated the world music craze. Helped lead to it, too. But
right.
What I'm hearing is you're saying it's been a little left out.
Well, yes, especially, you know, September 11th has really changed the way Americans view the world around them. And I think there's a certain amount of xenophobia. And some of these messages, which, you know, Bob was very radical, I don't think are as popular today as maybe they were, even though in some ways they should be more popular today because of the state of the world that we live in. But outside of the United States, it's amazing how popular reggae is, especially in Europe and Africa and even South America, and how, you know, the Congos could do a show and, you know, very few people were in the audience. So we are seeing somewhat of a, and I'm not sure if it's intentional or just, you know, you know, things go through phases. Who knows?
Chris Wilson, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Chris Wilson is Vice President of Artists and Repertoire at Heartbeat Records and joined us from the studios of member station WBUR in Boston. And let's listen to a little bit more of Bob Marley. This from one of his greatest periods around 1970, due in no small part to his association with producer Lee Perry. Here's a song put out with Mr. Perry titled Mr. Brown. Bob Marley. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Roger Steffens, that song is around the same area. You were talking about just a moment ago with Chris Wilson about releases. Bob Marley got a contract with Island Records that promoted this world artist, this third world artist, in a way the same way rock bands were.
They did, and before I go into that, let me just tell you a little story about Mr. Brown, because it's one of his most intriguing songs ever, and it illustrates so many different things about how the music worked. That was an instant song. The thing happened one day, and the next day, that record was on the streets. Mr. Brown was about a coffin floating through the streets of Kingston that eyewitness reports described as having three crows on top of the coffin, and they were asking for someone called Mr. Brown. And their line is, Mr. Brown controlled by remote. It may have been a publicity stunt for a local funeral parlor known as Brown's, but it was the talk of the town and the front page of the newspapers the next day, and the Wailers were on the road with that song within 24 hours.
Let me interrupt you, Roger.
Yeah.
We wanted to talk to somebody else. We mentioned earlier one of the biggest trends in reggae today is dancehall music, which focuses more on recorded music and program beats than more traditional reggae croonings. Here's a sample of some dancehall from rising Jamaican artist Tanya Stevens. This song Way Back from her new album Gangsta Blues.
No key, I mean way back to before people made a job of seeing who's back at impersonating Bob. I mean way back to when you sweat blood on every line to get one good song didn't cost $69.99.
And joining us now is Jamaican singer and DJ Tanya Stevens. She's with us by phone from Kingston. Good of you to be with us today.
Oh, my pleasure.
You mentioned Bob Marley in that song we just heard. Do you think reggae artists today are stuck trying to imitate the sounds and success of a giant like Bob Marley?
Well, many of them are. Many of them. I think a lot of artists miss the point that, you know, Bob Marley is Bob Marley because he was the only Bob Marley. And to get something similar to him, you'd probably need to have somebody else who comes out new and fresh and creative, different.
Rather
than somebody who imitates him.
How would you describe dancehall music?
I would say dancehall music is the pop culture of our youth in Jamaica. It's the more up-tempo, more disposable kind of music. I think it would be something comparable to dance music or to what rap is to R&B.
Mm-hmm.
Well, not that rap is that disposable.
Yes.
But, you know, our moves are at a bit faster pace. But it's what dancehall is to reggae, what rap is to R&B.
There has been, as you know, some controversy over lyrics in dancehall songs, as well as obviously in rap music as well. This is a long way from the spirituality of Bob Marley, in a way.
Yes, and it's somewhat of a departure. I don't think we really needed to stay with Bob's message because that was his, and if you don't share it, then you don't have to lie and say that you do. But a lot of our lyric really could stand some cleaning up. And, you know, our culture, we need to start teaching our people to appreciate personal differences. And you know, nobody needs our approval for their lifestyle. And this is something that many of us in Jamaica have been beating on for the past few years. But, you know, hopefully we'll get our message across.
Tanya Stevens, good luck with the record.
Thank you very much.
Tanya Stevens is a Jamaican singer and DJ. She joined us by phone from Kingston in Jamaica. When we come back from a short break, we're going to continue our conversation about Bob Marley with Roger Stevens, the reggae historian with whom we've been speaking. We'll also be talking about tourism after the tsunami and about the war in Colombia and how it is spilling across that country's borders. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Coming up in just a couple of minutes, post-tsunami tourism. But first, let's continue our conversation on the legacy of the great musician Bob Marley. Our guest is Roger Stephens. He's a reggae historian, and he joins us on the phone from San Juan, Puerto Rico. And let's get another caller on the line. This is Brad. Brad's calling from Portland, Oregon.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Just a quick comment more on the influence of Bob Marley on other musicians and other genres of music. You mentioned earlier in the show at the Rainbow that he did in 1977 in London. That show was hugely influential on the nascent London punk rock movement.
Hmm.
The original punk rockers, although they called for kind of a termination of the original rock icons like Elvis and the Stones, they did embrace Bob Marley in the reggae music. There was a real kinship between the punk and the Rasta, both forms of music kind of being of the lower class and of the working people, and really rebel music and a way of life, like your guest earlier had said. Artists, you know, like Joe Strummer and The Clash, all the way up to Johnny Cash, to name a few who really put their own spin on the music. Just wanted to bring that up and let you know about
A philosophical as opposed to a strictly musical influence. What do you think of that, Roger Stephens?
Well, you know, one of the last songs Joe Strummer recorded, Brad, was Redemption Song.
Mm-hmm.
You aware of that?
I am, and it really moves me.
Yeah, it's beautiful. There was an organization in the late 70s in England called Rock Against Racism, and Steel Pulse was particularly involved with them. They didn't quite like getting all the gobs of spit hurled on them when they were singing their anti-oppressor songs, but they soldiered on through.
Thank you very much for taking my call.
Brad, thanks very much for the call. And we wanted to read one final email. This was from Matt in Portland, Oregon also. My wife and I traveled to Africa in 1996 and backpacked extensively for 6 months. One of the things that struck us most on the journey was how present Bob Marley was in the culture of the countries we visited. People played his music everywhere. Once in Malawi, we were hitchhiking and we passed a dirt embankment where someone had carved out in big letters, "One Love." It seemed a wonderful testament to the man and to the power of his message. A man who's being talked about now on the 60th anniversary of his birth, a man who died tragically of cancer at the age of 36, but left a remarkable legacy. Roger Stephens, thanks very much for being with us.
Neil, can I mention a few seconds worth of upcoming Life of Bob Marley shows that I'm doing in his honor?
I guess you can.
Tomorrow morning at the University of Puerto Rico, Saturday night in your neck of the woods in Washington, the 9:30 Club with Third World, and then later in the month, Boston, Springfield, Mass., Hartford, Connecticut, and Cleveland. And I really appreciate what you've done for Bob today, Neil. Thanks so much.
Roger, thanks very much for being with us, and good luck with your presentations. He mentioned just a moment ago Redemption Song, recorded at Bob Marley's last concert. Let's take a listen.
Just a part of it, we've got to fulfill the mood. Won't you help to sing another song of freedom? Is all I ever had. Redemption songs, redemption songs. Sing on with me, children, in every way now, in every day, in every way, in every day. Emancipate yourself from mental slavery. None but ourselves can free our mind. Have no fear for atomic energy.
cause none of them can stop the time. How long shall they kill our prophets while we stand aside and look? Some say it's just a part of it. We've got to fulfill the book. Won't you help to sing? Oh, another song of freedom. Yes, yeah. Tis all I ever have. Did you know? Redemption songs. Sing the harmony. Redemption songs. Sing on with me, children. It's everywhere now. It's every day.
Redemption Song from Bob Marley's last concert.